thoughts on apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard the screen door slam. And a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? The key paradise put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
Thank you, Joni Mitchell. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight we'll be talking with Kyle Harper. He's a professor at the University of Oklahoma. He has a recent book titled Plagues, plural, upon the Earth, Disease and the Course of Human History. It looks at how the progress of civilization has also created opportunity for increased spread of disease. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Neil Yelland, a financial advisor with Edward Jones in Chico. No matter where you are in life's journey, Neil can offer guidance and strategies for wealth and retirement income, college savings accounts, estate and legacy plans, charitable giving, and more. For a consultation or more information, Neil can be reached at 530-345-8913. He's on the corner of 3rd Ave and the Esplanade. Neil Yelland, Edward Jones member, SIPC. And Ecotopia is made possible by J&J Automotive in Chico, with over 19 years of experience in auto repair and scheduled maintenance. They specialize in Subaru and Volvo. J&J provides everything from manufacturer-suggested vehicle maintenance to all types of repairs, including transmission and engine repair, brake and suspension, tune-ups, lubes, filters, lights, and more. To book an appointment or to get more information, visit jandjautomotivechico.com or give them a call at 530-891-3328. We want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. We'll hear a little bit about staying alive and then our interview with Kyle Harper.
is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 in Chico, and our guest on the phone is Kyle Harper. He's a professor of classics and letters at Oklahoma University. He's a multidisciplinary historian and author of a new book, Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease and the Course of Human History.
This book is a comprehensive study of ancient and modern diseases and epidemics. It's more than comprehensive. It's a doorstop of a book. It challenges the traditional notion that civilization always brings about progress. A major theme or thesis of the book, which we want to explore tonight, is that progress often has its price in the form of the spread of disease, including pandemics. Welcome, Kyle Harper. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start. In the introduction of the book, you list numerous conveniences that today keep us protected against disease. Toilets, disinfectants, refrigerators, chlorinated water. But you also assert that throughout our history, progress has often intensified the perils or actuality of disease. You call it the paradox of progress. Perhaps you could explain that theme for us.
Well, I think it's one of the big patterns of human history that really we can understand by trying to bring with us to the study of the human past the tools that a natural scientist, somebody who studies microbiology or ecology, might bring with them, because that actually will help explain why it's really not so paradoxical at all, because the little microbes that cause disease in us are really just organisms that are trying to do what anything else that's alive is trying to do, which is to spread its genes. They're parasites. And if there are more of us, or we're living more closely together, we're more interconnected, then that's going to play into their hands as well. So I think one of the really great themes of the long human story is that we have succeeded as a species in multiplying and spreading over the earth and developing new technologies that have made life more comfortable and increased our population. But this always has unintended consequences that sort of reverberate in really unpredictable ways. And infectious disease is one of the really powerful ways that our progress comes back with unintended consequences that ultimately can also hurt us.
The book is really a history of civilization. We very much enjoyed reading. I was only joking when I called it a doorstop, but it is.
That's true, though.
It is pretty hefty. We found every paragraph demands close reading and assimilation. This is not something you can read page by page as a page turner. It was 4 years in the making. We'd first like to know, how did you go about studying this really vast topic?
Well, you said it was 4 years in the making, and I started writing it in 2017, just as I finished my last book, which was a study of the environmental history of the Roman Empire. I'm really trained as a Roman historian, and I just got fascinated with the very powerful role of the environment, both climate change, but especially pandemic disease in the Roman Empire. And so I wrote a book about that completely got me hooked on the importance of infectious disease, the study of infectious disease, and how much we're learning right now. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to put the Roman chapter in a bigger perspective, and I think it's been a while since a historian's tried to tackle that. But also we're learning a lot right now, mainly from DNA, the same technologies that have made commercial ancestry companies kind of ubiquitous, and you can send in your saliva and get a DNA result that tells you a little bit about your past. That's also happening for the microbes that cause disease. So as a historian, that's really exciting. And it prompted me to want to try and tackle this bigger story.
So I have another question, because that's what my job is. Did you know when you started this, you were going to put Rome in the context of the larger history of disease? Did you know that it would be what you discovered it was? I mean, did you say in advance, okay, yeah, this seems to be the way things go? Or did you make some discoveries along the way that surprised you in terms of what they said about the way disease progresses?
Yeah, I'd say a little bit of both, but more the second option, that really the effort to narrate the big story of our species and its relationship to infectious disease came almost with a series of nonstop surprises. And I think it starts with just the really amazing fact that we don't think about this enough, but human beings have a very unusual disease pool. If you compare us to chimps or any other mammal, we have a lot of diseases. They're very nasty, and they're very narrowly focused on us. So I say the human disease pool is unusual in its number, nastiness, and narrowness. And there's no other animal that really has a disease pool that is kind of even analogous to ours. And so that to me is just was a, such a powerful sort of discovery that it surprised me along the way and kind of motivated me to keep writing and to explore why do we have this really terrible disease pool? Where did it come from? And the answer really, in a word, is history. And you have to combine history in the sense of our ongoing expansion over the earth and ongoing technological progress with the story of what that does to nature and how nature responds to us. So I think that was just sort of the first and most basic huge surprise. But the other one is that evolution is relentless and fast. And in a way, our history has sort of sped up the processes that cause the emergence of new diseases. Mm-hmm. And evolution is all around us. I think this is a general insight of biology in the last generation, that evolution isn't something that's always slow and sort of glacial or geological in its time scale. And particularly when you talk about microbes, their generation times are so short and their populations are so big, they're always evolving. They're always experimenting and trying new things. And as we've multiplied, it sort of intersects with the relentlessness of evolution. It means that new diseases are emerging all the time. And in fact, in the modern world, I think faster than ever.
So one of the things that we talk about in climate change is that it's happening so quickly that various species that are having to adapt can't adapt quickly enough. If it were slower, as things have evolved in the past, that they could evolve in order to survive with climate change. So disease, right, if it's evolving faster, then that's trouble.
It is. I mean, I think you're right. And one of the basic realities of the world that we live in is just that every organism on the planet is now under pressure to survive in a human-dominated planet. Right. And that, of course, includes climate change, but really everything about the way we live and use the planet. And so we're driving evolution. And often that, unfortunately, means also we're driving loss of biodiversity and extinction. Mm-hmm. But it also means that microorganisms that can live on a human-dominated planet are going to be successful in evolutionary terms. And so that includes things like SARS-CoV-2. It's a virus that is, it's winning evolution right now. Our vaccines have given us a really powerful tool to stall it. But it's evolving, and it clearly is very adapted to take advantage of a human-dominated planet. And that's just the story of the world we live in.
Could we get back to what is paleo genomics or genomics, and how has it aided your work?
Well, it's a mouthful.
And I didn't say it
in
right.
In the book, okay. I use a little easier term for it, time travel. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the really exciting things that's happened for people who are interested in the human past, because we have new tools and we're learning things that we not only didn't know 10 or 20 years ago, but we almost couldn't have imagined that we would know. So paleogenomics is really a combination of DNA sequencing with archaeology. And so it's specialized labs that can take bones of human or animals that are buried in past contexts and extract little, tiny little fragments of DNA that allow them to reconstruct the genome either of the person that died or sometimes of the microbes that swam in their blood. And so this is telling us a lot about human population history, but it's also taking us back and giving us new insights into the diseases that killed people in the past by letting us sequence the genome directly. So that's why time travel is a good moniker for it, because it's like going back in the past and sequencing the DNA that was there. And so this has been a real watershed, because it's let us identify the causes of past pandemics. The Black Death is probably the most famous pandemic in history. And historians really really hotly debated what microbe caused it. And that debate is absolutely over because the genome of the bacterium known as Yersinia pestis has been repeatedly recovered. And so that lets us not only know something that we really wanted to know, but it then lets us ask new questions. So this is a really revolutionary technology for studying the past of life on Earth.
And you remark in the book, too, that genome sequencing has become rapid. The human genome took, what, 10 years to decode?
Yeah.
Now people throw it into the machinery, and outcome answers very quickly.
Yeah, and that's really the technology that underlies this. It's called next-generation sequencing or high-throughput sequencing, and it's the same basic principles that machines that are very powerful at reading chemicals that are the strands of your DNA. And exactly as you said, think of the Human Genome Project that in the 1990s finished early in this millennium, took 10 years to reconstruct one human genome. A really powerful standard genome sequencing machine can sequence hundreds of genomes a day. And so that's why these ancestry companies can take your saliva and for $100 can sequence your genome and tell you certain things about you. So it's a really extraordinary revolution in our understanding of evolution and of DNA.
And all that's kind of mind-blowing to some of us senior citizens. I took college genetics now about 60 years ago, and I'm fond of telling people that DNA hadn't even been invented when I took genetics. It was all old Mendelian, you know, working with the sweet peas. Perhaps we could get a couple of examples about how the unintended consequences. You talked about Rome. Why did Rome fall? Simplistic question, of course, but give us the perspective from disease.
I wrote a old book on it, and so you know it's hard to be brief. But since you're twisting my arm, I'll say, to tell a story, to answer a question like that, we have to really have both human and natural factors. And so I think in the past we've too often told the story of why did Rome fall purely in human terms, and those are important. We have to understand how the empire worked, where its stresses were. The Roman emperors had trouble getting taxes and building armies. There were barbarian states across the borders that wanted to challenge Rome. So we still need all of that good social history to understand how the empire worked and where its stresses were. But I think we've learned that that's not the whole story, and that really dramatic environmental change, particularly short-term climate change, and I think above all, mortality from pandemic disease played a role as well. And so my answer to that question is that it's a combination of human as well as environmental factors that include, first and foremost, the impact of epidemic diseases like the bubonic plague, the same disease that caused the Black Death, and which also shows up in the twilight of the Roman Empire and seems to have caused a very devastating pandemic. Hard enough, hard for me to do, I got to tell you.
Okay. Well, one that I was interested in especially was, you said Napoleon wanted to basically unload Louisiana to the United States. He wasn't just looking to make money off the land. Why did he want to get rid of Louisiana?
Well, this is something I only am able to devote a paragraph to in the book. That's one of the hard things about writing a book like this. Like you say, it's kind of a doorstop, and yet everything I write about, I feel like
there's more.
Could be a book, and there's a couple of really good books about this. My favorite is one called Mosquito Empires by a really wonderful historian named John McNeil. And he has a chapter that really explores the role of yellow fever, which is a really terrible disease, a major disease in the early modern world, to the 17th and especially the 18th century. It's a viral disease spread by mosquito bite, and it caused these massive epidemic waves. And particularly newcomers, so people who came from Europe to the New World and had never been exposed to it, were just laid low by the thousands by this disease. And so John McNeil chronicles this very well, that when the English and French were fighting these imperial wars in the late 1700s, they would send over these massive armies and navies, and they would just get annihilated by disease. And this is true throughout most of human history, that disease actually kills more people than violence, even in war. But in this case, it really makes it hard for the European powers, and particularly France, to hold on to their New World possessions. And clearly, as we could put it, the kind of the virus seems to fight on the side of the good guys, the revolutionaries in Haiti, slaves who are fighting against colonial rulers and slave owners, and then, of course, the revolutionaries in the American colonies. And so the sort of people who had been here in the New World had a kind of disease or health advantage over armies that were sent in. So there's no doubt that somewhere in the calculus of Napoleon saying that holding on to the New World is simply too expensive in the power politics of his world, and obviously that's a huge calculus, is the fact that it's just so hard to send armies across the Atlantic without losing a really unacceptable proportion of the troops.
Mm-hmm. Throughout the book, you're careful to avoid explanations of simple causation. For example, Bacon's attributing progress to the printing press, the compass, gunpowder. And you've divided your book into four main categories or themes: fire, farms, frontiers, fossil fuels, to understand the effects on civilization and disease from those. Can you talk a lot about that?
Yeah. I mean,
this is your book.
The hardest things about writing a big history of humanity, where you're trying to cover all 300,000 years of the past of our species, is how do you even begin to organize it? And there's no perfect way, but I think, again, I try and look at the human past the way that somebody coming to it from, say, the field of ecology might. And you can look at human history by thinking of us as a species within nature that has to get energy, that has predators and parasites, and try and look at our own past in the way that we might look at the history of any other organism. And I think if we do that, we can try and organize human history around the really big energy transformation. Mm. And so fire is sort of the original technology. In some ways, it's what makes us us. It's actually probably controlled before there's even Homo sapiens. It's probably Homo erectus who first controls fire. But it's really the first great technology, because it lets us spread over the earth and it lets us make other technologies. And it creates a unique relationship between humanity and nature. So that's sort of the way I frame the early evolution of humanity. And I think it's important for disease, because we do spread out over the world and we come into contact with a wider range of microbes and parasites than any other ape that exists on the planet. And then from there, farming is obviously one of the most consequential energy transformations in human history. It changes everything about the way we live and die. The transition from hunting and gathering, which is how we spend about 95% of our history as a species, to sedentary agriculture is really a revolution in health as well. And it creates the environment where new diseases emerge and infect humans. And so it really is one of the great turning points. And I also argue that the rise of globalization in the modern world, the crossing of oceanic frontiers that unite the old world and the new, that unites Europe and Africa, Europe and Asia, is really also deserving to be considered a big transition. And it clearly has huge effects on the spread of infectious diseases when transoceanic sailing gathers pace in the 16th century and onward. And then finally, of course, fossil fuels. It's the energy basis of the Industrial Revolution and changes everything about the way people live. It leads to massive urbanization, the rise of modern transportation that allows the spread of diseases, and also creates the world that we live in terms of the rapidly accelerating emergence of infectious diseases.
So each of these, I want to kind of explore the theme a little bit more. Each of these represents a certain kind of progress where people are able to control their environments more, they're able to shape their experiences more, but there are downsides of all of them. And so can you talk about that more? Let's start with fire. Fire, allows people not only to do things. I mean, they can shape things with fire as well as use fire for controlling their environment. So could you talk more about that?
Yeah, the fire is an amazing technology that lets us really become the species that we are. But it also means that we're very adaptable. And so most other primates, like chimpanzees and gorillas, they really can't go anywhere. They're very adapted to their tiny little niche. Very, very good at living in that niche and getting food from it. But, you know, chimpanzees are confined to equatorial Africa. They can't sort of decide to go try and live on the shorelines of India, or we're going to go see what's happening in the Central Asian steppe. They can't adapt to those environments. Whereas humans, because of our intelligence, our social nature, and particularly because of our technologies like fire, we can live anywhere. And it's a really amazing feature that in some ways helps define us. It creates human diversity that we can. We can move beyond our
Oops, we lost you. Can you hear me?
Oh, am I there?
Yeah. Okay.
Good. Okay. So I was saying fire lets us move out of our ancestral niche and really adapt to almost everywhere on the planet that can be inhabited. But the flip side of that is that we also meet the pathogens that are laying in wait and that can potentially adapt to us. And so one of the basic reasons why we have so many different diseases is because we live in every environment. And so as we spread to the Pacific, as we spread throughout Asia, as we spread to the New World, we're encountering new ecosystems, new animals, and everywhere there are also new microbes. And so we can start to see the emergence of an unusual number of infectious diseases already in the really, really deep past, even before farming, really even before we're fully Homo sapiens, as early forms of hominins are spreading over the earth.
So how does that relate to fire? Just the mobility that you
the
have
mobility,
through fire?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. There's no way we could adapt to so many different environments if we didn't have our intelligence, our social cooperation, and then, of course, our technologies that are all grounded in the control of fire.
And it's also a parallel story, in a way, with farms. I'd sort of read always about farms as a great advance in civilization, allowed people to get away from the hunter-gatherer routine, come together in cities, and this in turn led to the evolution of politics, government. You need somebody to take over and control things, but there were downsides as well. Would you talk a little bit about that?
Exactly, and I think you put it just right, that there are advantages, and there are reasons why human societies transition from hunting and gathering, where they're taking food from the environment, from wild sources, to farming, where they're making food through the domestication of plants and animals. And clearly the transition was driven by a desire for more food. And when there's more food, there's a population explosion. So the transition to farming is a real watershed in the spread of human population and increase in our numbers. It's also, first and foremost, it's sort of a change in the everyday environments where humans live. So hunters and gatherers, of course, they move around a lot. They have to move with the seasons for the most part, and they have to find and the plants that are in season. So they live in highly mobile camps, and they live in very small groups. And that actually really constrains the options for parasites to adapt to them, because there aren't big numbers and they aren't standing still. Whereas once there's farming, humans are sedentary, so farmers have to stay with the field. They can't generally just up and leave the land that they've worked hard to cultivate. And they live surrounded by animals, so livestock like pigs and goats and sheep and cattle. Are part of the human environment, and their numbers are greater, and they're living more densely. So the transition to farming allows the rise of first villages and towns, and then eventually cities. And so all of this series of changes in the way we live and the environments that we inhabit creates new opportunities for infectious diseases. And I think one of the big ones that I try and talk about that I think hasn't always got the attention it deserves is the really unusual number of diseases that are spread in waste matter. So these are diseases that are transmitted via the fecal-oral route. So they are transmitted out the gastrointestinal tract of an infected body, and they generally reach usually water and pass to the mouth of the next host in contaminated water, but also in food or dirty fingers or flies. And humans have a lot of these diseases. We have an unusual amount of diarrhea and dysentery. And the reason really is because of the lifestyle of sedentary farming. We're surrounded by our waste and the waste of animals. So it's a great example of an unintended consequence of a change that brought many advantages, but also had many unforeseen disadvantages too.
I live on a farm, and I just recovered from Giardia. I know of what you speak.
It's still there, right?
We're going to go on and talk a little more about the fossil fuel era, what Kyle calls the Great Escape. But we'll tell you, this is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Professor Kyle Harper of Oklahoma University about his new book, Plagues Upon the Earth, just published this past month by Princeton University Press. We also want to tell you that coming up at 6 o'clock tonight, it's Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take, interviewing local movers and shakers. And alert you that on Thursday, a week from Thursday, November 11th, Gail Kimball on Ask Dr. Gail will be talking to Ashanti Branch, founder of the Ever Forward Club, which provides support for African American and Latino males who are not achieving their potential. She's established a global network that helps out some of these kids, and she says they have a 100% graduation rate. So be sure to tune in Dr. Gail, a week from today, Thursday, November 11th at 6 o'clock.
And this is Ecotopia. As we said, we're talking to Kyle Harper about his new book, The Great Escape. I mean, fossil fuels, wow. Part of the great escape from one of the worst plagues and pandemics includes the development of very sophisticated healthcare systems. We have hospitals. We have public health. Actually, I was interviewed by a public health person about my Giardia. We have quarantine. We have vaccines. People are paying attention to us. Is there a downside to those kinds of improvements in healthcare?
Well, I think that we can say that the control that human beings achieve over the last really two centuries is, first of all, it's one of the most extraordinary accomplishments of our species. And so it's easy to forget that even around 1900, most people die of infectious diseases, even in the most wealthy societies at the time, which would be the U.S. and Great Britain. And the control of infectious disease that comes about through all the different things that you mentioned is accomplished by Enlightenment science, translated into public health and biomedicine, and good policy that provides public health and sanitary infrastructure, clean water, and that has allowed human life expectancies to more than double. And that's true, of course, in wealthy countries, but it's uneven around the globe that there's still massive differences in life expectancy. But even in countries with the lowest life expectancy, there's been very meaningful progress and improvement. So I think we can recognize and celebrate that achievement. It's important to understand it. I think particularly now, just to be blunt, in a world where people are increasingly questioning vaccines, to tell the story of what smallpox was like and how humans gained the upper hand on it. So it's relieved human beings of just a immeasurable amount of suffering and early death, physical pain and anguish, and that's just an amazing accomplishment. But it, of course, also has unintended consequences, and the reality is that there are about 1 billion humans on the planet in 1800. That's a lot. There's no other large body primate that has anything like, there's other primate that has anything like those kinds of numbers. So there's a billion of us in 1800. Today, there are almost 8 billion humans. Mm-hmm. And that happens largely because of technology that controls infectious disease, as well as improves levels of agricultural output that allows people to not starve to death. And so this is one of the paradoxes of modern history, that that science has relieved suffering, but it's also caused our numbers to explode. And I think we're all familiar with the unintended consequences of a planet where there's 8 billion people, and the demands that makes on finite planetary resources, the waste that's generated by human consumption, obviously poses some of the biggest challenges that our global society has to confront in the coming decades.
What does it do with viruses and bacteria? How have they thrived during the Great Escape?
Well, I think we often tend to have, sometimes just in the back of our head, the idea that because we gain so much control through this series of innovations like quarantine, vaccination, sewage systems, mm-hmm. chlorination of water, antibiotics, and other vaccines, we tend to think, hey, we're winning. Humans are getting the upper hand. And that's to a very large extent. There's obviously a lot of truth to that. We're gaining systematic control. But nature never stands still. Evolution doesn't stop. And in fact, quite the opposite. As we've multiplied from 1 billion to 8 billion, there's, in a sense, there's more opportunity and more incentive for microbes to adapt to us. And so I try and tell mm-hmm. the story in those terms and think about the great emerging diseases of the last two centuries of the industrial era. Cholera is a new disease in the early 19th century that spread on railroads and steamships. The great influenza, the rise mm-hmm. of polio, the rise of AIDS, which is the most important new disease of the 20th century, along with others in a really unbroken series that leads down to COVID-19. So far from sort of seeing COVID-19 as somehow breaking the pattern of history, I think we can instead see that modern times is this buildup of tensions between our control and the world of nature that has a lot of incentive to try and spin off new microbes that are adapted to take advantage of us.
Let's talk a little bit about COVID. You wrote the book during COVID and comment upon that. And you did say it's part of a deeper pattern described by the interplay of ecology and evolution. So was COVID or something like it inevitable on the scale that we're experiencing at the moment?
Absolutely. And we said this before, that I started writing it a few years before COVID, and I had mm-hmm. originally intended and framed the book as kind of a warning that the patterns of history would lead us to believe that we were still very vulnerable and we should be far less complacent about the risks of infectious disease. And obviously, microbiologists and public health experts have been warning us about this, and now they sound like, you know, voices that went unheard, but mm-hmm. they really were. And as early as 1991, the American Institute of Medicine commissioned a blue ribbon panel led by a Nobel Prize winning microbiologist who studied microbial evolution that was meant to just wake people up and to say, this is one of the really big destabilizing threats that's out there. And since 1991, when that happened, we've had a series of near misses, including two other coronaviruses, the one that causes MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, mm-hmm. and the first SARS-CoV-1,
right. mm-hmm.
as well as other, you know, diseases like Zika and West Nile and Ebola. It's been a very scary emerging disease. So the pattern, even of the last generation, we've had a sort of nonstop series of close misses, and yet we were, as a whole, very, very complacent. So we were warned that something like this was going to happen. Nobody could have predicted that it was going to be exactly the kind of virus it was or when it was, although we were told by microbiologists that RNA viruses that mutate very quickly and that cause respiratory disease and spread via the respiratory route were the highest risk. COVID-19 actually happened sort of right where we were told to be prepared. And then, you know, the rest is history, or at least we're living through history. But the answer to the question is something along these lines was really bound to happen, and we were caught off guard even when we shouldn't have been.
So you're saying in some ways it's predictable. People who study these kinds of viruses, they know something about what's coming down the pike. Can it be more predictable? Can people who study viruses or other infectious diseases, can they narrow down or zero in on what's coming down the pike?
Well, yes and no, and I'll qualify this that I'm a historian.
Right.
But I do think a lot about the interplay of microbial evolution and human societies. But I think the answer to your question is both yes and no. And let me say what I mean. It's yes because we have the capacity to invest in the study of the emergence of infectious diseases. There's a huge amount of this going on, and over the last 10 or 15 years, there'd been more American research funding in this area, largely because of Ebola and the first SARS, but not nearly enough went into researching where are the hot spots where wild animal populations are likely to come into contact with human populations that are a threat to be reservoirs of novel pathogens that can adapt to humans. That was, in retrospect, you know, if we'd invested more in that and understood better where the zones of emergence are likely to be, as well as what are the mechanisms, you know, which viruses are the most dangerous, and how can we build systems of surveillance that allow us to catch the emergence of diseases earlier? Mm-hmm. So I think there's a growing recognition that we can do more. The Biden administration's pandemic preparedness vision that they've started to lay out includes much more investment in the sort of exactly what you're talking about. How can we get better at predicting? But there's always wild cards in evolution, and sure. I think it'd be hubris to expect that we can ever completely predict what evolution is going to do. And I think history tells us that we have to expect the unexpected. And there may be, even though COVID-19, as I said, struck exactly where we were told to be looking.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The next one could be something totally off the wall. It could be a drug-resistant fungus. It could be a prion disease. Evolution is so weird and so pervasive and so relentless that it's impossible ever to be able to predict fully. And so it's important from a policy perspective, too, that we invest in other ways of being resilient, because we can never fully control nature and we can never fully stop diseases from emerging. So we need both the scientific and social responses that are going to help us handle the next pandemic more effectively.
What do you think, you talked about climate change with Rome, and that exacerbated or fed into anyway the fall of Rome. What role do you think climate change has in infectious disease development and change?
It's a great question, and there is a ton of very good research going on, because this is going to only be a bigger and bigger question. And I think the sobering answer is that, from my perspective, we don't fully know what the mechanisms of relationship are going to be. I think historically there's a very strong pattern that times of climate crisis and climate change seem to coincide or correlate with moments of infectious disease, and we can learn from that. Sometimes it's because climate crisis stirs desperate migration, so it reduces people to miserable situations where they're utterly desperate and they become very vulnerable. And that's a humanitarian tragedy in its own right, but it also is very dangerous both for themselves and others. So migration is a link. Simply food shortage and scarcity. The human body is a complex machine, and it needs a lot of energy to fight against pathogens constantly. And when people are hungry, they're not healthy.
Right.
And clearly, climate crisis that causes food shortage is likely to affect human health and promote the spread of diseases. Another big mechanism is through disease vectors. And so as right. so many of the worst diseases and most dangerous diseases and most sort of befuddling and hard to control diseases are spread by insect bites, particularly mosquitoes.
Yes.
And mosquitoes are very, you know, finicky creatures, and they're very environmentally sensitive. So if and as climate change changes their geographical territories, it will change the dynamics of infectious disease. So as you can see, the links are really complicated, but they're, they're also very real. And I think it's another area where we need very quickly and urgently to broaden our understanding of what we're likely to face in the coming decades.
So what are your do you have a project after this? I mean, what are your priorities as you're thinking about, you know, this is a really significant issue. It's not, you know, this was really interesting. I enjoyed writing. This is a really significant issue. Do you have projects related to this that you want to follow up with? Or do you see a further direction you could go with this project? Or are you done?
No, well, yes and no. I mean, I'm certainly enjoying having finished writing a book stop and being able to step back a little bit and try and think about where I want to invest time and energy. And I'm still very active as a Roman historian, and there's a lot of fascinating stuff going on in understanding the plagues that hit the Roman Empire. So part of me will always put my heart and my time there. But I do think some of these environmental challenges that we face really urgently need a deeper historical perspective. So so I still kind of have my interest in global environmental history. One of the things that really fascinated me about working on this book was the role of animals. And so I've been thinking a lot about the ways that historians might contribute to our understanding of the history of other animals and biodiversity and human impacts on biodiversity, which we know a lot about certain moments, like the end of the Ice Age, when human hunters seem to play a major role in the rapid extinction of large animals, the megafauna. And we know a lot about the current moment where we're living through what's sometimes called the sixth extinction,
yes.
because it only has a few parallels in the history of the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
But I think as a historian, there's a lot that goes on between the Ice Age megafaunal extinctions, the end of, you know, mammoths and mastodons and saber-toothed cats and so on. And the kind of recent human-driven mass extinction. So I've been thinking about kind of the deeper history of biodiversity and the role that historians might play in helping us reconstruct that story in full, and the way that story is really important for us to understand and confront the moment that we live in.
Biodiversity in a garden is really, really important because I have a friend who says, just let this go. You have a diverse garden. There'll be something that come, you know, like there'll be a pest of some sort. There'll be something to take care of that pest because your garden is diverse and integrated.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if there's anything like that in disease control, in infectious disease control, that if there's a diversity that maybe it will control itself rather than attacking humans.
I think so. And I think we're obviously about to play out a very dangerous experiment. And what happens when you dramatically reduce biodiversity, unfortunately. But as you know, there's a chapter, a long section of a chapter in my book that really I shouldn't have got away with because it's a little bit off topic, but I got so fascinated by the story of plant diseases, like you're talking about pests and what happens in the 19th century when you have steamships and railroads, and people get the very questionable idea that you can just take certain strains of really anything, whether it's potatoes or bananas or coffee bushes or wheat strains, and just wipe out everything else and put up that one strain, because the same thing keeps happening over and over. When you do that, they become very vulnerable to large-scale outbreaks.
Good
farmers. So I have a long section of the book that's really about plant diseases that come about as a reduction of biodiversity.
Right, and that's a huge issue in farming, is how the lack of biodiversity has been destructive to a lot of the strength of the plants and that we have.
It is, and but it's always a devil's bargain, because everybody wants the bigger tomato or the sweeter strawberry, but the kind of collective problems that follow from that are harder to foresee in some ways. So it's a huge challenge.
Yes, it is.
It's a fascinating book. It's called Plagues Upon the Earth, Disease and the Course of Human History. We got a complimentary copy from the publisher. If anybody who's a listener would like to send us an email, ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We'd be happy to share that with you and beat Kyle out of royalties from at least one copy of the book.
Be a good cause. It'd be for a good cause.
But thank you. Fascinating. We look forward to following your work. I really admire the comprehensiveness of this book. I was joking about it, but it's an incredibly complex, detailed book, well worth reading.
So our guest has been Kyle Harper, author of Plagues Upon the Earth, published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being with us, Kyle. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
The pleasure's mine. Thank you.
A little spooky music from the film Contagion, which starred Gwyneth Paltrow and Matt Damon, a prophetic film made in 2011. When Gwyneth comes back from abroad with a mysterious ailment, nobody can figure out what it is. And as Kyle Harper has predicted in our interview this evening, perhaps a byproduct of civilization, overpopulation, mass transit, and other problems of our society. You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. We always invite your comments on our program. Send us an email. We're at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. You can also listen to recordings of and download copies of our programs at our website, ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. That's it for Ecotopia for tonight. Remember, you are the new day. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
There's contributions of KZFR supporters and by the Cotton Party, offering contemporary women's clothing and accessories with an emphasis on natural fibers in the heart of downtown Chico. Cotton Party has been providing friendly service for over 30 years at 337 Broadway Street. Cotton Party is grateful for your business and offers complimentary gift wrapping with each purchase. More information by calling Cotton Party at 893-4923. And by The Printed Image, providing screen printing and embroidery in Chico since 1980. The Printed Image, open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and by appointment. More information at 530-898-9525.
Today
first date give and take, I am going to interview Marty Dunlap, who is a wonderful friend of mine. So this is kind of an especially good interview for me.